Geopolicy, podcast from geopolicy.com. Now, it's been 3 weeks since Russia invaded Ukraine and none of the major cities have fallen yet. So what we want to do today is go through some of the tactical aspects of this war. We've got Adnan Khan, the founder of Geopolicy, to unravel all this for us. How are you doing, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Now, it's been over 3 weeks since Russia invaded, but Russia's military, it seems like it's really, really struggled to make any big moves in the country. From a military perspective, how would you describe where things are right now?
So 3 weeks, you would think that's pretty early to be reviewing the overall war. However, there's been so many bizarre things militarily that have been done by Russia, so many shocking things, that it's probably a good idea to review where the war stands and what they're trying to achieve. You know, just to give a caveat, despite many of the things that have gone wrong, it does appear now that Russia is adjusting and it's trying to fix a lot of the problems which are of its own creation, really, in order that the war goes in the right direction for them. The best place to start, which probably gives a bit of an indicator why things haven't gone according to plan from a Russian perspective, is Russia clearly, looking at the way they deployed, looking at the fighting that they are doing, they based this war, the invasion of Ukraine, on a number of assumptions. And these assumptions very, very quickly unraveled. And as a result, they've been forced to make some significant adjustments. These assumptions include the Kremlin believing that the Russian military in just a matter of days could probably overthrow the regime. The Kremlin, it seemed, they assumed that Kiev would fall pretty quickly, that there would be little resistance, and as a result, there won't be a protracted war in Ukraine. Now, if you go to war with such assumptions, that has an impact on everything, how much material you're going to put aside, how many units you're going to use. And that's what it seems came to haunt Russia. There's other things. For example, there's been a complete lack of air warfare, which is shocking. There's been no use of electronic or cyber warfare from Russia. And it now appears from many of the POWs, prisoners of war, that have been captured from the Russian side, that the army was really informed about the war at the last moment. So many of these troops probably weren't even psychologically prepared when they crossed the border into Ukraine. So 3 weeks in, there appears to be four main fronts to the war. And if we go in clockwise order, you've got the north, where troops went in from Belarus down as a column to try and take over Kiev, the capital. And this is quite significant. If Kiev was to fall, the war would effectively be over. But what we've seen is a 40-mile-long convoy that's sitting there. And in any air war, that will be a sitting duck. And it seems what's actually happened is the Russians pushed so many units down this same route that they all got stuck. So really, for the last 3 weeks, Russia's been trying to sort this out. It's been really, really slow. They took Chernobyl, which doesn't even make sense. They will probably argue the Russians, they're taking back Chernobyl. They were the ones that created the problem in the past. But why on earth would you take Chernobyl, which is a nuclear disaster? You're now responsible for it. So if we go clockwise, if we go to around 2 o'clock, so the northeast, this is where Kharkiv is. Now, originally, this was the most successful advance from Russia, but now it's facing supply shortages. And this has actually been a common problem in this war. The logistics and the supplies has been terrible. And that's actually what's forced Russia to really slow down and get bogged down in many, many areas. Now, obviously, they entered the war thinking that there's going to be very little resistance. That was an assumption that turned out to be completely incorrect. And now they are forced to readjust. So, 3 o'clock, so looking at the Donbas region, fighting continues in this area, but very slow progress from Russia. They got a lot of pushback from Ukrainian forces and the Ukrainians who were putting up resistance. And it's taking up so much resources now that Russia is forced to resort to its reserves. So if we go further down to around 4 o'clock, so southeast, this is the Donetsk and Mariupol area, which is getting a lot of media attention at the moment. What seems to be happening in this area, things have slowed down to such an extent that Russia is just shelling infrastructure and civilian areas. So the hope here is by shelling them, by destroying infrastructure, they will capitulate. Now, Mariupol looks like the worst at the moment. It's probably going to fall, but it's going to be a hollow victory if you've had to literally just shell the area to submission. And we've got to keep in mind that there must be a political objective here, which is to remove the regime and install a new regime. And if you want the people to accept that, shelling them, massacring them isn't going to help. Then in the south of Ukraine, this has probably been the more successful. And what happened here was is a number of cities had been captured pretty quickly by Russian forces, and this then allowed them to use railways to bring up supplies. Now, keep in mind, in Crimea, Russia already took over this area. It occupied it. It's separated it from Ukraine, and Russia already had a military presence in this area as well. So this has probably been its most successful. The only problem is the capital, the political capital, is in the north. So despite making a lot of progress in the south, politically that doesn't really aid Russia. From here, it would seem they want to go further west and take over Odessa. And I don't think they can with the logistics they've got at the moment. They're going to have to bring in more and more supplies in order to do it. So in summary, Russian forces continue to face significant difficulties. They're now forced to mobilize replacements. So that's why now they're bringing in Syrian mercenaries. They're bringing in other mercenaries to fight because their own troops have been struggling. And keep in mind that they've been forced to use conscripts because of the very, very bizarre assumptions they had that this will be a very quick war and it'll be over really, really quickly.
Now, I guess we need to give some credit to the Ukrainians and their resistance. What's been their strategy in pushing back the Russians?
Okay, so the Ukrainians, on paper, they should really have no chance. You've got probably one of the largest armies in the world with lots of equipment. And what the Ukrainians have tried to do is utilize their advantages. So their country is quite large. Ukraine is, I think, the largest country in Europe. So what they've tried to do is do hit and run attacks across Ukraine where Russian forces are in order to overstretch them. Also, what they've tried to do is take advantage of the terrain. So they've been trying to draw Russian forces into their environment, into urban areas. And obviously in urban warfare, the Ukrainian people have the advantage because you've got the advantage of hiding behind buildings, you know the terrain, something similar to what the Taliban did in Afghanistan. So obviously they've received a lot of military equipment over the years. They've been training as well. And I think we can definitely say they have actually caused significant problems for Russian forces. That's why they've got bogged down. It didn't help the Russian forces that they assumed there would be little to no resistance. And that's why the Russian forces are having to bring in a lot more equipment. Getting equipment from Russia to the front line during a war is no difficult. It's not a simple feat. If that equipment was already there, you can make use of it. But now having to get it there, the logistics can be a complete nightmare. So the Ukrainians are taking advantage of a lot of the assumptions that turned out to be wrong for the Russians. And they are utilizing the terrain to their advantage. Now, that doesn't mean they can win. What they can do is hurt Russia. They can fight on attrition. They can economically make it very, very difficult. Even if the Ukrainians win, they lose in terms of the country being bombed back to the Stone Age, the country being leveled. But for the moment, 3 weeks in, there don't seem to be any attempt by the Ukrainians to give in or just to give up and just accept a defeat. So what that means is for the Russians, this is now turned into a long slog. It seems the Russians thought they could just do a raid into Ukraine, send in a few forces, you push them up to the capital, and you do that, they'll basically win. That hasn't happened. So yeah, that you've got to credit the Ukrainians for.
Now, whenever I think of Russia, I always put it up there with some of these other countries such as France, Britain, America in terms of its power. And Ukraine, you always think of it as quite a poor country. We always hear about the Russian army, it's modernizing. I just don't understand why it struggled so much. Are any of these issues linked to the collapse of the Soviet Union in the past? Why has Russia struggled so much?
So this really gets to the crux of Russia's military problem. Russia really has been modernizing its military for the last 30 years. Really, in the 1980s, Russian generals realized that warfare was changing. The Soviet Union had a huge military, had more tanks than you had soldiers, had a zoo of variety of vehicles. It was a massive force that didn't necessarily have decent equipment, but due to sheer quantity, they could overwhelm everyone. And in the 1980s, they realized, the Soviets, that warfare was changing, that precision-guided weapons and cyber warfare, these were going to be the new ways of fighting. So rather than sending a large army, utilizing technology could defeat large armies. And then this obviously played out in 1991. Iraqi forces were organized and structured on Soviet lines. However, at the end of 1991, Soviet Union collapsed. And really what happened then was Russia went through a decade of depression. So there was complete economic collapse. The industries collapsed. For the last 10 years prior to that, they were already in dire economic straits. So what that meant was the Russian military had loads of equipment that was rusting, that they couldn't maintain. that they couldn't even replace. So throughout the 1990s, Russia was really a hollow force that had nuclear weapons. And that's why they struggled in Chechnya. That's why in 1994, they were effectively defeated in Chechnya, and then they pursued a ceasefire with the Chechen rebels. So when Putin came to power in 1999-2000, he then began attempts to modernize the military. And that was when he launched the war against Chechnya, which eventually they won in 2001. However, these reforms Putin started, they've been very start and stop. They're still incomplete even today. And the reason why is because of the economic cost. Russia needs to replace loads of equipment. When we talk about modernization in the military, what that is you get rid of your old equipment and you replace it with new equipment. But Russia has so much equipment, whether it's fighter jets, whether it's artillery, whether it's tanks, because the Soviet Union always prepared to fight a people's war. So that's been their fundamental problem. The area Russia still struggles with today, if you're going to replace your military equipment, then you need to design new up-to-date equipment that you can use for the next decade or so. But Russia still struggles with the design and production of new weapon systems. And interestingly, Ukraine actually was the key to the Soviet Union because it produced everything from gas turbines for Russian ships to helicopter engines and the like. And obviously, once the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine became a completely separate country. So now, that's not to say Russia hasn't improved in any areas of its military. In terms of anti-air fire, in terms of missile defense, it's done very, very well. But your war is going to be your ground forces. They need to have the logistics to go and fight. That is the area they're still trying to improve. They're still trying to modernize. So modern Russian army is much smaller than the Soviet Union. It has less vehicles. It has less equipment. But what Russia's trying to do is make sure they have more up-to-date equipment. And Russia doesn't want to be buying these in like many countries do from other countries. Russia wants to develop its own defense industry. And that's another area Russia struggled in. Because of economics, Russia has a large population, although it's shrinking, and it has to prioritize where this funding is going to be going. So Russia's military has struggled through a number of wars because it struggled to modernize and replace most of its military with modern equipment and modern methods as well.
When I look at Russia's history in the last 20 years or so, I find that it's actually done pretty well for itself. So you've got Georgia in 2008, the conquest of Crimea, Donbass in 2014, and then its involvement in Syria from 2015. And these are all examples where it shows that Russia militarily is actually a force to be reckoned with. Why have they struggled still so much in Ukraine?
That's a good question. I think there's a couple of things here. One is Russia has done a really good job of projecting its victories in these wars. So externally, abroad, Russia has presented Georgia, its invasion of Georgia in 2008, its conquest of Crimea, as Russia is an effective military that can invade other countries. However, internally, Russian officials have been very scathing of their performance in these wars. To give an example, it's similar to winning a war, but you lost 90% of your troops. You won the war, of course, but look at the cost. And each of these wars actually revealed the many, many problems Russia has in its forces. But due to sheer quantity, Russia was able to win. But that's not the lesson the Russians took. The Russian officials were very scathing of the performance. Obviously, for propaganda purposes, it was utilized differently. They projected to the world that we're a country that should be messed with and we should be taken seriously. So if we take the first war, the one in Georgia, and that was quite interesting because that was Russia's, effectively, it was its first war after the Soviet Union collapsed. Now, it wasn't really, but the Chechnya war was the first war when the Soviet Union collapsed. But the Georgia war, Russia actually realized it's got significant problems in its military. The Georgia war was firstly a very limited operation. Although we call it the Georgia War, Russian forces only went into Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which were breakaway regions in Georgia. So it was a very, very limited war that required a very, very limited force. The lesson it taught the West was Russia's back. The lesson the Russians took was the complete opposite. They realized that a lot of their equipment didn't physically work. On the communication side, which is absolutely critical for modern warfare, Russia performed absolutely badly to the point soldiers were forced to use telephones in Georgia to communicate with their units back in Russia. So although Russia won that war, that wasn't the lesson the Russians took. The lesson they took, because they were fighting a country like Georgia, who actually was using very, very old Soviet equipment, it was because of the sheer force of numbers that Russia actually won. That was the lesson they took. The conquest in Crimea in 2014 was a very swift operation. It made Russia look very, very good. However, Russia already had a naval presence in Crimea. It had 18,000 troops there. It had logistics there. It had military equipment there. So when Russia took over Crimea, it didn't have to send a force from Russia to go and conquer it. It already had a naval base there. Russia, very cleverly, it projected a war that it won. However, the war was very different in Crimea. It literally, these troops in the naval base, they took over key areas from Ukrainian forces, and Ukrainian forces gave up because they were already there. So Crimea really isn't the normal war they're going to face. Then you've got what happened in Donbass, eastern Ukraine, which Russia took over at the same time as well. Again, this is the region of Ukraine that already had separatist tendencies. It already was out of favor and critical of the Ukraine government in Kiev. And the separatists already were being trained and armed by Russia anyway. So when these areas became separate and Russia supported them, these were the separatist areas already anyway. So already Russia had the advantage there. Russia didn't need to send in massive forces, go and occupy land, go and supply the troops that are there. That wasn't the case. Russia has some troops there, but most of the work was done by mercenaries and separatists that were already in that region. And then the last was Syria. Syria really was a small to medium operation for Russia. At most, Russia had about 5,000 troops in Syria. And the sole purpose of Russian forces was to lead the air attack across Syria. So Russia didn't need to put troops on the ground, and it didn't. So yes, Russia fought a war quite far from home, you know, about 300 kilometers, I think it is, or 500 kilometers Syria is. So you got to sustain operations, you got to supply your troops. But by siding with the regime in Syria, they were given bases. These bases were protected. And therefore, Russian forces were never out of harm's way because they were just carrying out massacres. So yes, all of these wars, Russia looks very strong, but those are not the lessons Russia took. In fact, Russia realized it's actually got significant problems. And each of these cases, if you look at Georgia, if you look at Crimea, if you look at Donbass, if you look at Syria, largely they were fighting civilians, they were fighting militias, they weren't fighting a peer competitor where a lot of their logistics would have been exposed. So yes, Russia is making headway, but in a way, all these wars Russia's won, there were significant political and strategic things that went in their advantage. If that wasn't the case, a lot of Russia's problems would have been exposed, which we're now seeing in the first 3 weeks in Ukraine.
Let's talk about the other side. NATO doesn't really want to get involved. That's what it seems anyway. What factors are preventing them from getting involved?
So really, NATO and NATO countries, they don't really have the stomach to intervene. This isn't Iraq or Afghanistan, where you're fighting militias or civilians. You're going to be fighting Russia, which is a nuclear power. And despite all its shortcomings, it can bring a lot to the battlefield. Also, NATO doesn't really have a good track record. Last 20 years, NATO was in Afghanistan, and we saw the humiliating withdrawal last year. NATO may look good on paper, but the last 20 years, its performance in Afghanistan has been woeful. The Taliban, who are not even a conventional army, it put them to shame. So you've got that factor. I think the other added factor is if NATO gets involved, that now means all NATO countries are a target for Russia because you're in the war now. So the Russians used a cruise missile last week and they struck a target in the west of Ukraine, close to the Polish border. This is where many foreign fighters are gathering. If NATO gets involved, Russia will potentially start firing across Europe. Now, if NATO was to get involved, this is effectively the type of war Russia is structured for. Russia is structured to fight a peer competitor that also relies on logistics and things like that. And also it will probably lead to an air war as well, which will expand it. And now we're talking about World War III type scenarios. I think we want to keep in mind that there are political objectives, and the political objectives for Russia are it wants to protect its borderland areas. And if NATO gets involved, then this is an existential crisis for Russia, which now means Russia can make use of whatever weaponry it has at its disposal in order to defend itself because it's existential. So there's these sort of factors really which I think are key. But probably I think the key thing really being is I don't think NATO really has the stomach for a war because if you look at the performance, it's not been great recently.
Let's say hypothetically they did get involved. What would the war actually look like then with NATO involved?
So likely what will happen is that all this talk of no-fly zones, you'll see that there'll be an air war. So you'd have jets taking off from the Baltics, from Germany, from Poland. So the war will basically go into the skies. You'll see a lot of logistical movement. I suspect Russia will start carrying out missile strikes across Europe as well. The interesting thing here would be is this wouldn't be, I feel like, World One, World War Two, where you'd have a massive troop movement to go and occupy land. But the problem now you're going to have is troops will become sitting ducks. So probably the war would expand into the air realm, into the cyber realm, and possibly even space, utilizing satellites and drone warfare, which we're seeing already as well. So the likely chance would be, with NATO getting involved, the war would go more high tech and the battlefield would drastically expand.
You mentioned that the battle will take a different style, so the Air Force will be more involved. Why isn't the Air Force involved at the moment?
So I think after the war, this is going to be one of those much-studied subjects, that why on earth would Russia not bring his Air Force? Russia started the war in Ukraine by carrying out a few military strikes. We've seen helicopters, but very few of them give close air support. But Russia has lots of jets, it has lots of bombers. It could easily deploy them and take out Ukrainian targets. But we've seen the cyber area and the Air Force have been completely absent. In fact, it seems the Air Force has completely sat the war out. Now, we're speculating, there could be a couple of reasons. If your plan is you want to join Ukraine with Russia, if your plan is you want to integrate in some form or shape with Russia, bombing the country back to the Stone Age isn't going to help that. So I think that a lot of the problems Russia's had is because of the assumptions it had. But also, I think there's certain things it just can't do because politically it won't achieve its objectives. In many ways, conquering Ukraine, overthrowing the regime, being the political goals, means you're limited on how you're militarily going to achieve that. You can't do what they did in Syria, where you just drop unguarded bombs across the whole country. You carry out massacres. You destroy infrastructure. I know now they resort to that in some areas. But if your plan is you want to join this country with yours or politically have influence over it, you're going to have to establish a regime that's loyal to you. That's not going to work if you're bombing the country back to the Stone Age. I think that could be one of the reasons why it's taking it very easy with its air force, with the use of missiles as well. These will be the key areas where Russia would have utilized to win the war. The other thing could be that Russia has problems in terms of bringing its air force into the war, in terms of logistics, in terms of capability. Now, I've seen that online. I don't think that's the case because we've seen Russia's air force take part in Syria. We've seen them take part in many of these military exercises, and I don't think that's the issue. I think despite all the problems Russia has, despite its struggle to modernize, it can still bring Soviet jets into the fight, and that will still be significant because Ukraine doesn't have a huge air force, and also it has even fewer of the ground logistics needed to keep your planes in the air. So I think after the war, we'll find out really what happened, or in time, all the people that were involved in the decision-making, we find out why the Air Force wasn't deployed. It could be the Air Force is holding out in case this expands and Europe gets involved and NATO gets involved. You don't want to throw all your cards at the beginning of the war. What you do, you've got to save them for later if and when certain things happen. So I think all of these reasons potentially could be correct, and we'll probably just have to wait and see in time what it was.
Putin's held back their air force, but he's actually put his nuclear forces on alert. Why would you? What's his motive behind that? What are the chances of nuclear? Which is a big question in a lot of people's minds.
This obviously gets a lot of attention. It's got a lot of media coverage in the West. I think it's one of those things where it's very easy for Putin to say this, but he doesn't really have to do anything. So he said he put his nuclear forces on alert. What does that actually mean? And there's no tangible thing we can measure to see what that actually physically entails. It upped the ante. It got Putin a lot of media coverage. It got a lot of Westerners worried. But physically, after 3 weeks, it's made absolutely no difference. Russia's still struggling in the war. Russia's still struggling logistically and to supply its troops. Saying it, I think, got it a lot of media coverage. It got a lot of people to stand up and take Russia seriously, but it practically has meant little on the ground. It could have even been a slip by Putin, because Putin, in a lot of his interviews, he's been quite angry. He's been quite flippant. In fact, there's an argument the whole war is very, it goes against the way, the modus operandi of Putin. Putin's a very calm, very collected person. So we'll have to see. Nuclear war doesn't really serve Russia, neither does it serve Europe. Nuclear war in Europe would mean there's no borderlands for Russia to protect itself, and you're going to get a massive radioactive waste in that area. No more Russian energy going into Europe. From the European side, nuclear war, you know, you won't be able to live on a chunk of Europe anymore. And people around there won't be able to live there anymore. So a nuclear war doesn't really serve anyone's agenda, I think. And Russia has lost wars and not used its nuclear weapons. You look at Chechnya, you look at Afghan withdrawal, the Afghan war in the 1980s. Both of these wars, Russia lost, and Russia withdrew and it never used its nuclear weapons. So I think this is part of the propaganda war, it's part of the political war. When things weren't going well in the first week for Russia, Putin pulled this out. And you know, the propaganda war is as important as the real world. Though Russia's completely losing the propaganda war, we see Ukrainian women preparing Molotov cocktails. We see Ukrainian refugees coming into Europe. We see nothing of the battle from the Russian side. Now, some of it's probably because Russian TV and broadcasting's been banned. But nevertheless, the propaganda side, we're not seeing anything at all. In fact, Ukraine's winning all of that. So I think these sort of things probably feed more into that. From a, you know, if your forces are struggling on the ground, nuclear warfare is not going to change that. The political goals, if they are to remove the regime and control Ukraine, a nuclear war would just mean on Russia's border, you've got a massive nuclear wasteland, and that doesn't serve even Russia's agenda as well.
Thank you for your time today, Adnan. Now, we at Geopolity are very closely watching what's happening in Ukraine. So if you want more updates on this issue, you can follow us on www.geopolity.com, and we'll be discussing many other issues on there. So definitely check us out. Thank you for your time. Take care.